So today we have a little bit different of an episode for you. I liked this week because I didn't have to do anything. It's a Matthew-centric episode. I really don't know what's going on. He wrote the story, and I'm still recovering from my cold, so I think he wanted to give me a light week.
Yeah, so this is a story that Michelle has heard of this guy, but doesn't know any of the details, and I wrote the whole thing, and we're just going to kind of get Michelle's reaction as we go along.
These are not my pants.
Hello, and welcome to These Are Not My Pants. My name is Matthew. I'm here with my lovely wife,
Michelle.
And this is episode 8.
8.
So, today we're doing things a little bit differently. This is a story that Michelle has not seen, knows very few details about, and we're just going to see how it goes.
Eek.
So I'm not going to tell you who it is right at the beginning. Well, you'll find out who it is later on in the story. For right now, it's just John. John was born March 17th, 1942, to a lower middle-class family living in the suburbs of Chicago. He was the youngest son of an auto repairman and a housewife. In school, he was overweight and not well-liked by his peers. John wasn't particularly intelligent or athletic. He actually couldn't play sports at all due to a congenital heart defect.
Aww.
John's childhood was a solitary one where he found himself being the unpopular kid who was constantly picked on by his peers. It would also become known that his father was an abusive drunk, and while his mother and siblings would occasionally get caught in the maelstrom, John Sr. had a special place in his heart for taking his frustrations out on his youngest son. It was rumored that the abuse towards John Jr. started as young as the age of 4, and that his father would repeatedly call him a mama's boy and a sissy.
Aww.
Aw, the 50s. At the age of 7, John was caught fondling a young girl alongside another neighborhood boy.
Oy.
His father beat him with a sharpening strap for bringing shame upon their house, though his father was later quoted to say, well, at least he's not a queer. It was also around the age of 7 that a contractor who was a friend and co-worker of his father began sexually abusing John.
Before or after the incident?
Hard to say. It was around the same time.
I would guess before, because usually when something happens to them, that's when they go and act it out on someone else, like a girl from the neighborhood.
It's possible. John didn't have many friends, but the few he did remarked that his life was completely dominated by his abusive father. They recalled stories where John Sr. would begin to attack and berate his son without any provocation whatsoever. These incidents almost always resulted in a beating in which his friends described a boy who was submissive, cowering in front of his father, only bringing up his hands to shield the blows, never fleeing, never fighting back.
So he was getting beat in front of his friends? Yikes.
That's what it sounds like. John would later state that he was never close to his father, that in his entire life they could never find any common ground or a way to get along.
Well, I mean, if you started beating me when I was 4 years old, I'd kind of have a hard time relating.
Indeed. Indeed. Things seemed to turn around when John became of age to drive. His father went out and bought him a car.
Nice.
Well, not exactly. John had to sign an agreement to reimburse his father for the total amount of the purchase price, and the low monthly payments soon turned into just another form of control. John Sr. would withhold access to the car anytime his son's behavior displeased him, which was often. The situation erupted after John Sr. removed the distributor cap from the vehicle. He was upset that he had found that John Jr. had made a spare set of keys. His father kept the part for 3 days as punishment. When John finally got his car back, he packed up his stuff and he left the family home. He drove to Las Vegas, where he found work as a mortuary assistant.
Yee.
He slept on a cot behind the embalming room.
Ah.
And from there, he was able to watch the morticians embalm the incoming bodies.
That's where it all started.
Right? If it hadn't started already, that was it.
Yeek.
Yeek.
And now I'm scared because I don't know what's coming. I don't know if I like this format.
It's fine. John, who would later state that his own action shocked him, called his mother and asked if he could come home. He would leave his job without notice and head back to Chicago in the middle of the night. On the drive home, his disturbing act probably weighed heavy on his mind. John had to wonder what overwhelming urge had prompted him to climb into a coffin and fondle the body of a recently deceased teenage boy.
No, a boy. Not that it's worse if it's a girl, but still.
Back at home, he resumed a normal life. He began attending Northwestern Business College. He landed a managerial job at the Nunnbush Shoe Company. He was transferred to Springfield. John was living his best years, what he described as the perfect life. He had a managerial job. He had joined the United States Junior Chamber of Commerce. He was even engaged to a pretty young coworker.
Female?
Female.
But he likes boys, right?
But he's got to keep up appearances. It's the 50s. You're not allowed to be your 60s. Like you're not allowed to be gay back then. It wasn't a thing. But all is not as picture perfect as it might appear. There was an incident, which of course John denies any culpability of, where he was sleeping at a fellow junior chamber member's couch after drinking too much and woke to one of his fellow council members performing oral sex on him. In 1964, he married Marlon Myers after knowing her for only a year. The next year, her father purchases 3 Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants, and the newlywed couple move to her hometown of Waterloo, Iowa, so John can manage the stores.
So he was the colonel?
He was now the colonel. Or managing for the colonel, I guess.
Junior
father-in-law
colonel.
Would be the colonel, right?
I guess
he's the owner. Together, they had 2 children, a boy and a girl. In Waterloo, John made a good living managing the 3 KFCs. He was making around $15,000 a year and was earning a share of the profits as well. And today, that would be like earning close to 6 figures.
Nice.
From the outside looking in, John was the picture-perfect, good, upstanding citizen, devoted husband and father. But John spent a lot of his time devoting to the Junior Council, and the Junior Council had a dark underside that included drugs, wife swapping, prostitution, and pornography.
Huh.
John also opened a club of sorts in his basement where he would invite his employees, but only the boys in their teens and early 20s,
sure,
to drink and play billiards.
Of course.
And presumably do drugs.
Uh-huh.
His well-structured facade was in danger of falling apart, though, after he was charged with sexual assault.
Oops.
In 1967, 15-year-old Donald Voorhees, son of a fellow JC member, was lured into John's basement under the promise of alcohol and pornography. He plied the minor with alcohol and coerced him to perform oral sex on him. John would continue to blackmail this young man for continued sexual favors for months while abusing several other boys as well. One story was given that he told some of the boys that he was part of a government agency conducting experiments on homosexuality and then paid boys up to $50 for their participation in the study.
So like a weird little prostitution ring?
A little bit.
Just for himself, though.
Just for himself. Another tale was told that he had a young man and talked him into sleeping with his own wife and then later blackmailed that young man into homosexual favors with him.
Oh.
Nice, right?
Smart guy.
If he could have done good with his smarts, maybe, instead of just evil. In March of 1968, Donald Voorhees finally told his father about the abuse that he had been suffering at the hand of John for months. Soon the police were at his door and more victims came to light. At least one victim alleged that he was chained, choked to the point of passing out, and then raped.
Ah.
John, of course, denied all the charges, insisting that it was all fabricated to derail his political career, and insisted that he be given a polygraph examination.
Huh.
The police complied with his demands and gave him a polygraph.
They found?
Yeah. They found him to be deceptive in regards to the 2 alleged victims. You can be a psychopath, but that still doesn't fool a polygraph. On May the 2nd, John was indicted on charges of sodomy. The avalanche was seemingly upon him. In a panic, he tries to hire 18-year-old Russell Schrader to beat up the young Donald Voorhees, hoping him to force to drop the case.
Nice.
The attack was successful. The young man was beaten pretty severely, but he would escape his attacker and report the incident to authorities.
Right.
Schrader, the hired thug, would quickly point the finger at John as being the one who ordered the attack, and additional charges were added to his docket.
Huh.
Prior to the trial, two doctors were given access to John for a psychological evaluation. The interviews were conducted over a 17-day period, and their determination was that John was in fact competent to stand trial, but that he had an antisocial personality disorder that included psychopathic tendencies. On December 3rd, 1968, John was found guilty of sodomy of a minor as well as some other charges and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. His wife, Marlene, filed for divorce that very day,
right,
was granted custody of their two children,
good,
and thankfully never had to see John again. But John was good at creating and wearing masks. In the Anamosa State Penitentiary, he became the model prisoner. He was promoted to head cook in the kitchen, as well as finally receiving his high school diploma. You already know what I'm going to say, don't you?
I have no idea.
John was released after 18 months. He was given 1 year probation. During this time, while he was in jail, his father did pass away. So as soon as he got out, he decided to move back home with his mother in Chicago and began working as a cook.
Okay.
In 1971, they bought a ranch-style house on the northwest side of Chicago at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue in Norwood Park Township. And then he got engaged again to another woman.
Ah.
This time to an old high school flame, Carol Hoff, who was divorced with two young daughters.
Does she know his history?
I'm guessing not. I mean, it was the 70s. There's no Google.
She couldn't Facebook.
There's no stalk Facebook. Him. You just had to meet a person and
trust.
Trust or not trust based on your interaction.
Like, right.
There was nothing else to go on. That same year, he was arrested for forcing himself on a teenage boy. But the charges got dropped because the victim failed to show up to court. The charge was never relayed to the parole board, so when John's year of probation was up, his sexual assault just disappeared into a sealed file.
Yeah, and they didn't have no registries.
There was no registry in the 70s. Their wedding was scheduled for July the 1st, 1972, but just 1 week prior, John was arrested again.
Oh my.
This time he was charged with aggravated battery and reckless conduct. Jackie D was the complainant, a teenage boy. He alleged that John had posed as a police officer, flashing a sheriff's badge, and got him into his car. And once inside the car, John tried to force a young man to perform oral sex.
How did he not get charged with impersonating an officer?
I don't know. Maybe that wasn't a thing.
I don't like the 70s.
Unfortunately, soon it would come to light, however, that Jackie D was blackmailing John, and therefore the prosecutor refused to try the case.
Huh.
John then started his own construction company, PDM Contractors, which stood for Painting, Decorating, and Maintenance. He was a very creative man. He left his job as a cook and started his own business, and his business started doing really well. John then bought a piece of property down in Florida and had a young male employee accompany him on the trip.
Of course he did.
That employee stated that John raped him the first night of their trip and then ignored him the remainder.
Aww.
When they returned home, the young man actually attacked John on his front lawn. His mother-in-law intervened, stopping the fight.
John's mother-in-law?
Yeah. When questioned by his family, John shrugged it off, just stating the young man was a disgruntled employee. On January the 3rd, 1972, John saw a young 15-year-old Timothy Jack McCoy outside a Greyhound bus station. Now, January on the north side of Chicago has got to be very cold.
Right.
Which might have made it easier for John to lure the young man into his car and take him home. There, he would stab him, bury the man in his crawl space underneath their house.
Ooh, is this is his first kill that we know of?
This was his first kill, yeah. And it would also be the only victim that he's known to have stabbed. All the other victims would die by ligature strangulation because stabbing was just too messy.
Well, you learn something in your first kill, right?
I mean, you'll see, there's an evolution. The second victim would meet John later that same year. John would bury this boy in the backyard. He was a minor, 15 to 18 years of age. This boy was killed and kept in John's closet for several days. John would later recount that bodily fluids had drained out of his mouth, staining the carpet in his closet, and he would develop the practice of stuffing their underwear into their mouths to prevent this from happening in the future.
Oh!
John's legal troubles seemed a distant memory. The fake personality that he created for the public was holding up well. He was back in politics by 1974.
What? How?
Exactly. He was appointed to the Norwood Park Township Street Lighting Committee. In 1975, he was made director of Chicago's annual Polish Constitution Day Parade. Through these events, John was granted special clearance with the Secret Service, was introduced and photographed with then First Lady Rosalynn Carter.
Shut up.
No, not even kidding.
Well, did they just not do any kind of background checks in the 70s?
Apparently not. But we got the picture of John with Rosalynn Carter. So we'll make sure we have that on the Facebook page.
Bananas.
July 31st, 1975, John calls employee John Butkovich, who has been complaining for about 2 weeks that he's owed back pay. Once the young man arrived at John's house, he was handcuffed, strangled, and buried under the concrete in the garage.
Huh, don't be complaining about not getting that check.
When questioned, John admitted that the young man had been to his house, but he told him a story about how he'd come for his back pay, they had reached a compromise, and then Butkovich had left. John would later join the search for the young man, claiming that he didn't know what happened to him.
Wow.
Through his political associations with different organizations, John found the Jolly Joker Clown Club, a charitable group that attended fundraisers and entertained terminally ill patients at the hospital. John really took to it, performing regularly as Pogo and Patches the Clown. Neighbors recounted how John would throw parties for the entire neighborhood, but he particularly seemed to enjoy dressing up like Pogo the Clown for the neighborhood children.
Scouting.
That same year, he would confess his homosexuality to his wife, which was not a surprise to her, as she had found gay porn in the house and had seen him on many occasions walking into the garage with teenage boys.
She never confronted him on this prior to his...
Again, it was the 70s, maybe, you know, good housewife doesn't speak up type of thing. I don't know. It's weird, right?
Uh-huh.
On Mother's Day, they had sex, and he told her that was the last time they would do so.
Huh.
They would divorce in March of 1976. Now free and unfettered from the lies and persona he had to put on for his wife, the true nature of John was really able to flourish. He would begin to lure boy after boy into his home, and few would live to see the next day. That very month, a young man by the name of Jeff Rignall alleged that John lured him into his car with an offer of marijuana before chloroforming and handcuffing him. Rignall stated that he was taken back to John's home before he was sexually assaulted and then later released.
So he is releasing some, even though he's already killed some?
I don't know why he chose to release this one particular kid. That definitely wasn't his MO.
Mm-hmm.
There was discussion later that his crawl space was full and maybe he didn't have... Maybe he didn't have another option.
I'm going to have to let you go because I'm out of backyard space, right. Crawl space.
I'm all out of crawl space. And
don't feel like digging tonight.
It's moist out back. I don't want to. He, of course, went to the police. But according to Rignall, he stated that the police started making him feel like he was the crazy one for bringing such a charge against such an upstanding citizen. John was charged with battery, but just ended up having to pay $3,000 in a civil suit. No criminal charges were ever filed.
So he's really cashing in on that politician thing, huh?
It's really working for him, yeah. Right. In December 1977, John was arrested yet again after a 19-year-old young man accused him of kidnapping and sexual assault. However, the charges were never followed by the DA as John claimed that the sexual was consensual. Once again, just skating free. On December 11th, 1978, Robert Peace met his mother outside the local pharmacy where he worked around 9 p.m. He told his mother he was going to meet a man that he had met about a construction job that would pay more than double what he was making at the pharmacy. He told her it would take just a few minutes, then they could go home and enjoy her birthday. She waited and waited, but Robert never came back.
Oh, on her birthday?
On her birthday.
That's the worst.
She drove home and retrieved her husband, two other children, and a pair of German shepherds before returning to the pharmacy, but they were still unable to locate their son anywhere. Peace went to the police department. The police had received numerous reports on John over the years, but for some reason had been unable to build a case against him. There was the report from the family of his previous employee, John Butkovich, who had gone missing while attempting to collect his back pay. His parents had pled numerous times with police to look into his employer, John Wayne Gacy, but nothing ever seemed to come of it. There was also the report of the young man who came in reporting that he had been kidnapped and sexually assaulted by John, but police dropped the case when John told them the sex had been consensual. When it came to light that John's construction company, PDM Construction had just finished the renovation on the very pharmacy that Robert Peast was working that led detectives to his door. Gacy returned the call of Lieutenant Kozinsek around 11 p.m. and agreed to come in, stating he would be there in about 30 minutes. Kozinsek waited until about 1 in the morning before assuming Gacy wasn't coming and went home. But Gacy did show up. He arrived at the police station at 3:20 in the morning with his clothing and shoes covered in mud.
Covered in mud? At least it wasn't blood.
The desk officer told him to come back tomorrow when the lieutenant was there.
Showed up at 3 o'clock in the morning, covered in mud.
Yeah.
Why?
Isn't that weird?
That is weird. Why are you covered in mud at 3 o'clock in the morning?
I'm assuming he had somebody else to bury real quick.
let me get this guy in the ground.
Hold on. Before you start asking questions, let me get this one more kid in the ground. They were able to meet later that evening. Kozinsek was able to interview Gacy and show John that he had a warrant for his home.
Oy.
Gacy was placed in a cell while police went out to search his house at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue.
Eek.
The police found several items, including a receipt the family believed belonged to Robert Peast, but no other evidence was found, and Gacy was released later that night, December the 13th.
They didn't check the crawl space?
No.
They didn't check those fresh graves in the backyard?
Apparently not.
Boy.
But police weren't done looking into Gacy. After that night, they began having two officers follow him day and night.
Nice.
Gacy jokingly called them his bodyguards, officers Michael Albright and David Hackmeister. I apologize if I'm hacking any of these names, were given the detail to follow Gacy wherever he went. Gacy was aware of his detail, would sometimes bring them coffee or even tell them where he was headed.
Like in Goodfellas when they go up and knock on the window.
Hey, wake up.
Wake up.
Time to get going. Albright was later quoted stating that Gacy had once said to him, "Clowns can get away with murder." Breaks in the case would come just a couple days later when a class ring belonged to a John Sick was identified amongst the belongings taken from the Gacy house. The young man had been missing for 2 years. Police also found that two other employees of Gacy's construction company had also gone missing. His murderous rampage would finally end officially on December 21st, 1978, when John Wayne Gacy was arrested for giving marijuana to one of his employees. This arrest was allegedly done because they believed him to be a suicide risk, and they were waiting to procure a second search warrant. Investigators leaned on Gacy, telling him that he needed to tell them where Peace's body was, and they were ready to start digging up the floors in his home. Gacy insisted that Robert Peast was not in his house. He finally conceded, stating that he had once killed a man in self-defense and buried him in the garage, even pointing out on the map where in the garage the body would be located.
Boy.
However, police found the hidden trap door that led down to the crawl space.
Eek.
There they found evidence of three bodies buried underneath the home. The investigation would continue for several days, ultimately finding many more bodies buried underneath the home. That's when the entire world learned the name John Wayne Gacy Jr., the killer clown of Chicago.
Politician.
Who was found to have kidnapped, tortured, raped, and murdered 33 young boys. 26 found in the crawl space under John's home. There's another boy found in the backyard. This man was not able to be identified.
33? 33. Oh, my goodness. And they're just like, here's the keys to the city.
Here, take a picture of the first lady. Friends and neighbors were shocked. They described their neighbor John as being kind, friendly, outgoing, forthright, trustworthy. In a statement from Gacy, he admitted to killing 32. He didn't go to the 33, including Robert Peast. He would claim that he had an alter ego named Jack Hanley who performed the most heinous of deeds.
And he wasn't a clown, that guy, right?
Probably not. On January 4th, Robert Peast's jacket was found in Gacy's home after he directed them to it. But it wasn't until April of 1979 that Peast was finally identified as one of four bodies that they had pulled out of the Des Plaines River. Gacy had apparently dumped them off the bridge as there were no more room in the crawl space.
Oh, ha, ha. Nobody smelt anything? All those bodies?
Apparently not.
Did he embalm them?
No.
I mean, he had that experience of working in that place. I didn't know if he picked up some skills.
As far as I know, he was just jamming their underwear down their throats and sticking them on the ground. The indictment for John Wayne Gacy Jr. was officially handed down on January the 8th, 1979, initially for 7 murders and a couple other felony charges. Gacy pled not guilty on January the 10th.
Huh.
April the 10th, they began demolition of the Gacy home at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. By April 23rd, they had updated the indictment to include 26 more murders, bringing the total up to 33.
Wow.
It took the jury only 2 hours to convict Gacy of 33 counts of murder, 1 count of sodomy, 1 count of sexual assault, and 1 count of indecent liberties with a child.
Aww.
He was sentenced to death on March the 13th, 1980.
Good.
By the end of the trial, of the 33 known victims, 8 young boys remained unidentified.
Aww.
So the investigation continues. Gacy would spend 14 years on death row at the Menard Correctional Center in Illinois. He appealed to the courts multiple times over the years for a new trial, but was always denied.
Good.
John Wayne Gacy was 42 years old when he was executed by lethal injection May the 10th, 1994 at 12:58 in the morning. Before he was put to death, he would claim one last time that he was innocent.
Wow.
The search to identify the victims continues. In 2011, a Cook County Sheriff's Office began an investigation using new DNA methods to try to match the families of the missing with the DNA of the victims of John Wayne Gacy. On November 14, 2011, they were finally able to release their first success story. They had identified William George Bundy as one of the victims, bringing closure to his family after more than 30 years.
Wow, that's awesome, though. Go science.
A second victim was identified in 2017, Jimmy Hawkinson, who went missing back in 1976. He was only 16 years old at the time of his disappearance.
Oh.
The Cooks County Sheriff's Office has stated that they will never stop searching for the identity of the 6 remaining victims. Facial reconstruction has been completed on 2 more of the boys, and I'll make sure we link their portraits that were created by forensic artists at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Investigators say that Gacy would often pick up hitchhikers or cruise bus stops for potential victims. If you have any information or recognize either of these boys, please contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. And that was John Wayne Gacy. What did you think?
I mean, that's a really high number. I feel really bad, like, for the 70s, I guess. Like they didn't... I don't know. I feel like it could have been prevented. Like,
I feel like they had him and let him go so many times.
It's just a shame. That's a really high number. And to have all those bodies in your crawl space, like, I'm kind of curious how close were the, like, neighboring houses, like, that you didn't smell something?
I mean, they were pretty close. It looked like your pretty typical suburban neighborhood.
Row house type. I don't know. I'm really surprised. And it just kind of shows you, too, that, you know, white boy politician can kind of get away with murder. I mean, 33 murders before he was caught.
And keep in mind at the time, you know, 70s, there's no DNA. There's no real forensics taking place other than fingerprints.
And all of his victims were male. There were no female victims.
No female victims, no.
And he had 2 wives.
He had 2 wives, but both wives survived. Like,
yeah. And what came of his children? Any information?
I mean, the 2 children that he had, thankfully, like I said, they never had to see him again after he was arrested the first time.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the, like, 2 thankful daughters that his new wife had, like, God forbid he had sons.
Right. Anyway, that was John. What a jerk. I mean, seriously. I feel really bad, too, for the parents of the little boy at the drugstore. Just,
I know, to go missing on your birthday of all times.
Right. That's horrible. Well, there you have it. Another bummer. Don't forget to burn your murder shoes. Bye, John.
Bye.
Jerk.
It's finally here. We now have These Are Not My Pants merch.
Whoop.
Support your favorite newbie podcasters and get yours today.
We have hoodies, both pullover and zip up, We also have tank tops, shirts, and my favorite, tie-dye. And we also have plus sizes.
Fatties.
Visit, that's us, by the way. Visit storefrontier.com/these are not my pants. That is storefrontier.com/these are not my pants.
The store is also linked on our Facebook and Instagram.
So get yours today. Bye. Burn your murder shoes. That hoodie is available. Bye. Now you might be wondering how you can get a hold of us.
We are on facebook.com/groups/these are not my pants.
We're also on Instagram.
Podcast not my pants.
You can email us at
podcastnotmypants@gmail.com.
And we're learning Twitter at
podcastmypants.
So that's how you can reach us. Please do so. We want to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening.